Right now, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio. It's a time where we take a look at the media coverage, what they're covering, how they're covering it, and why they're covering it. There's a lot of different reasons why we do this. David has his own website, which you can also find, which is, of course, themediabeat.us, themediabeat.us. You can also find him, of course, on demand here at robinhoodradio.com on demand, the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. And don't forget, he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we say good morning to David. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us again today. David, are you there? We have lost David. Is that possible? David? Now that's funny. We'll try this again. We'll see what happens here. We're getting the ring, so that's good.
Well, I hope I'm connected now.
There we go. We are connected with David right now. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning, you.
All right. So, we live in very interesting times and lots of...
you could say that.
You know, and we have to start off. You know, we all saw this coming, and this is why I love the BBC and why we carry the BBC. Our listeners... have been on top of the situation, what has happened once again with Downing Street going to get another occupant. This is a story that's not just a story about Great Britain, about England, about the Europe as a whole. This significant amount of changes coincides with other rough times for governments throughout the world, and this is just another example of the government coming to a grinding halt.
Grinding halt, sure. I guess I should put on my pickup and wear my old British media hat. Shop worn though it is, Marshall, to take in this media melodrama that's been emanating from Downing Street and the Palace of Westminster, you know, the Houses of Parliament in London. I'm not sure whether it's symptomatic of something in the generally in Western democracies or so-called democracies. Some European countries have had extraordinary tumultuousness in their politics recently too. I think of Italy. But Britain has never liked to think of itself as bracketed in the same sentence ever of political analysis with Italy, but changing governments quickly is a feature. Since the Conservative Party currently in power was voted into power 12 years ago now, they've had four different prime ministers, this last one surviving for only 45 days, as we know, and none of the past three of them was selected by the British people. That's the issue being addressed now. Liz Truss was chosen by a very modest electorate of 200,000 people, paid-up members of the Conservative Party, and it looks like her successor will be effectively chosen by an even smaller electorate, the party's members of Parliament, 357, I think, now, out of a total of 650 seats in the House. The rest of the opposition, Labour Party, with about 200, and the smaller parties, the Scottish Nationalists and Welsh, and one solitary Green Member of Parliament, not to be forgotten. Now, the turnover in leaders, I'm tempted to quote Oscar Wilde, to lose one parent may be regarded as a misfortune, to lose both parents looks like carelessness. I wonder what he'd say about losing four leaders. None of those individuals are especially fatherly or motherly, but they're always supposed to be in charge. And traditionally, the Conservative Party in particular has always been seen, especially by political journalists in the UK, as the pragmatic, common-sense political party. The chaos that's been prevailing recently is genuinely shocking. And BBC's Rob Watson, an old colleague of mine from when he reported on the UN here in New York, and I worked there too, he got surprisingly personal in one summary he gave. He said, in all my 40 years or so of reporting on British politics, I have never, absolutely never seen anything at all quite so chaotic. Yeah.
Well, you know, what's interesting in the BBC has pointed this out, unlike in American politics, when American presidents come into power, people they appoint to different cabinet positions, for better or for worse, have to get approval. And it's not that way in the United Kingdom. It's not that way in England. The person who comes in, as we found out with the current prime minister, can bring in her own people. And they're not necessarily the most qualified, as we saw in the rollout of their economic plan.
Sure, and sometimes the leader is not the most qualified either. But it's not the individual who's been chosen to be prime minister. It is a matter of party politics reigning supreme in Britain ever since the party system was devised 2 centuries ago. The Queen, or now the King, had the job of the only thing laid down admittedly unwritten constitution of the British Isles, Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It calls for the monarch to summon the leader of the party with the largest number of votes to ask them to form a government after a general election. And if for any reason they can't, then the monarch can ask another party. But it's done on a party basis. And once in power, the party can change its slogan, as it did with Margaret Thatcher, for instance. She was replaced by John Major, and that was entirely a matter of shenanigans within the Conservative Party. Nothing like the current shenanigans. It is a desperately serious matter, but I can't help reacting like a lot of the coverage with a certain amount of amusement and even amusement in a way. Perhaps it's an opportunity to just note the media frivolity here. I mean, far be it from me to suggest that British tabloid newspapers are frivolous, but let me tell you the story of the lettuce. Have you been following the lettuce?
No.
Well, the British, one of the less, the British tabloids vary in lightness and frivolousness, I guess, across the scale. Somewhere on the scale is the Daily Star, not a particularly well-known newspaper overseas, but it decided to stage a contest. It was all started by something at the very other end of the scale, not a tabloid at all, the august magazine of analysis called The Economist. The Economist said that, actually 7 days ago, interestingly enough, 7 days ago it said that Liz Truss had the shelf life of a supermarket lettuce. And the Daily Star's response to this was to go out and buy a lettuce in a supermarket, place it in their office, photograph it, wearing a blonde wig, incidentally, and set up this competition to see which would last the longer, the lettuce or Liz Truss. And as we know, she was out within 7 days, and on the seventh day, the lettuce was crowned triumphant. It gives you some flavor of the coverage in Britain. But to be serious now, the argument has to be, it must be, and it is, of course, about that question of the role of the British public. Can there be now a national general election because of the government collapsing? The opposition, the Labour Party and the others, obviously wanted. I mean, all the opposition parties wanted, but perhaps it was put most firmly by the Scottish Nationalist leader, Nicola Sturgeon, who wrote a striking tweet. And actually, to quote it, I think I better revert to my original accent for this. There are no words, she wrote, to describe this utter shambles adequately. It's beyond hyperbole and parody. The reality, though, is that ordinary people are paying the price. The interests of the Tory party should concern no one right now. A general election is now a democratic imperative. Miss Sturgeon always writes in the Scottish Voice, but that's the point, of course. I mean, the British people have had no say about these changes, and they're going to have, it would seem, no say in this either, in this current one. The choice is to be wrapped up in 7 days, remarkably enough, and the rules, once again, are being changed. The Conservatives are pretty flexible with their so-called rules when it comes to electing leaders. So there's now a much larger role to the parliamentary party, only if there are still at the end of say 6 days from now, two contenders in the running. Only then would it go to that wider electorate of 200,000 members of the party who would be able to vote online to decide between the two contenders, if there are two contenders at that point.
Well, I think when I look at this, and to me the long-term play for the Conservative Party, it doesn't matter what, is that the longer this instability happens, and you have this many changes in governments over the course of a period of time, sooner or later, there's an old commercial, sooner or later, you know, you got to go see your car repair person. Either it's early on, and
in fact, you probably have to trade in, right?
Yeah, either you get the problem fixed right away, or you keep kicking the can down the road doing different things, and then eventually, you're right, okay, I guess I got to get a new car. And in politics, it's, okay, I guess I'm going to vote a different party. Sooner or later, that's going to happen.
Yeah, and this parliament, as it's called, this tranche of people voted in by the entire electorate of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, comes to an end, constitutionally speaking, in 2025. I, for one, cannot imagine this Conservative government, whoever leads it, managing to right things sufficiently that they win the next general election at that point, even if that amount of time elapses. It's possible that someone with extraordinary leadership qualities could turn it around, but nobody suggests themselves as an individual capable of that sort of leadership, but we'll see. The leadership, the contending members of the field are not inspiring, I don't think. The best people, it seems to me, in a situation like this to turn to for any sort of helpful predictive opinion or analysis are Britain's bookmakers. I leave the political journalists behind because, like my own self, you know, I never see journalists making good predictors. But the bookmakers have something, you know, they have some skin in the game. They've got to get things right, but their odds are in declining. Order of likelihood, starting with the most likely, is Rishi Sunak, the finance minister who ran against Liz Truss and lost, of course, to her. And then next is Penny Mordaunt, who's currently the leader of the House, a sort of Nancy Pelosi figure, except that she also has a seat in the cabinet, so she's she straddles the executive and the legislative side of British government. But she is not well known to the public, I don't think. She's something of she's definitely wholly a creature of public relations, the public relations industry. And then third is an interesting name, Boris Johnson. Heard of him? And then the last one, Ben Wallace, who's a former soldier who is now the defense secretary. Not a field that inspires a lot of confidence, I don't think.
Okay, we'll move away from the what's going on there and to something I don't think the media has covered enough here. They've mentioned the stories, but I think they haven't linked it together. I look at it as the Supreme Court of the United States stepping back a bit and making some decisions to possibly change what the public thinks. The latest opinion that they've come up with is they've stayed quiet on the Dobbs leak investigation, and they also have stopped the attempt to block President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. And on top of before that, they also backed off with Mar-a-Lago. It's almost like they're trying to take the heat off of people speculating what they're doing.
Well, I'm sure they themselves would say that they're just making purely legalistic judgments about purely legal matters. But it was the opinion emanating in particular from Justice Amy Coney Barrett offered us a finding in which the Supreme Court, as you say, backed off or declined to rule against a prime piece of Biden policymaking, the easing of student loan burden for many, many people, up to $20,000 at least, a popular measure, of course. I think that may have featured in the justices' considerations, and as always, of course, the Supreme Court, in theory at least, is answerable to the great American public. So that sort of consideration could well have played an important part. If something is popular, it's probably not a good idea to rule against it, even though that, as we know, has not applied in the matter of abortion rights. A sizable majority of the American public, when polled, are in favor of abortion, with some restrictions. But that didn't prevent them from overturning Roe v. Wade in the now infamous Dobbs case. And indeed, propelling the abortion issue into something that seems to be working as a rallying cause for the Biden side of the equation, the Democrats in general, for the midterms, which we mustn't forget are just a matter of a few weeks away.
All right, and one final footnote for this show. Steve Bannon is set to be sentenced. What do you think that sentence might be like? You know, when somebody in such a public eye and is involved in such a public storm, you would like to think that's not the case, but you tend to think that the Justice Department and judges really want to make a statement an idea with what Steve Bannon's being charged with comes up.
Well, yeah, in a week when ex-President Trump has finally caved in to a subpoena and sat down to be deposed for the case in which he's accused of rape, it's very interesting to see that his lieutenant, Steve Bannon, will be making news yet again today as a federal court in D.C. decides on how to sentence him, since he was found guilty of defying a congressional subpoena in the January 6th House investigation. Federal prosecutors want him sentenced to 6 months in jail, plus a $200,000 fine, I think, while Bannon himself has asked to be only put on probation, you know. Okay. They have a penalty in mind, Bannon's own lawyers. But the prosecutors say that they're pressing for the maximum penalty, as you say, because, and I quote them, because a person could have shown no greater contempt than the defendant did. It will be something of a test of the judiciary's position, I guess, and it'll be interesting indeed to see how Bannon fares. It comes in a week also when an intriguing article is published by the New Yorker, long in gestating, a lot of research has gone into it. It's about one of Bannon's friends or colleagues or associates, I don't know quite how to call them, a man called Miles Guo, a Chinese entrepreneur, billionaire, in fact, no question about it. And it's a remarkable story about a man who is eventually a self-confessed agent of the Communist Intelligence Service, becoming a mover and shaker in Trump Republican circles. It's an extraordinary story, and it says a lot about the Trump crowd, I think. It's a remarkable... I don't know. The fact that such a man in such a set of associations can mainly by using his money to support Trump and Trump's own close advisors like Bannon and Giuliani, who got a lot of money from Guo as well, that is a measure, as the New Yorker says, of the influence of very peculiar and unwanted centers of influence and power in this country, and in this case, emanating from someone who, one way or another, was able to get asylum in this country as a mega rich. A member of the Chinese aristocracy, if you like, who supposedly broke with the intelligence service. So there's lots of evidence produced by the New Yorker that suggests that, he's still in cahoots with the Chinese authorities. It's an intriguing article. I recommend it.
All right. Once again, David, it's always great to chat with you. There seems to be a plethora of things that pop up week after week on the world stage that needs to be investigated by the media. And we appreciate your time. Once again, David's website is themediabeat.us. David, have a great weekend. We'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that. Bye-bye.
David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Once again, you can find David at themediabeat.us, and you can also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.